strangle her. My tiny butterfly butters my bread. My briny flutterby keeps me well fed. Why should I mutter? Stunned by this last rebuff, I rebound. On the way back, I hear me saying to myself, dwell in your shell. One thing about life, be it said, it feeds upon itself over and over, and of itself is fed. Should I love you as I love myself? Suppose I hate myself. I would be as free to hate you too. I am never quite educated, never quite so, but I am ever in the painful process of becoming so. You remember me and my song. Only such immortality strikes creative sparks from my soul because of you. Who could wear out their welcome there when there is no welcome there to wear out? There is where it is, here on earth.
Today is Monday, August 27th, 2011. 22nd, 2011, and this is CITR News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good afternoon. It's 4 past 5 o'clock on August 22nd. This is News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin. And today we're going to be talking about a tragic loss in the NDP party federally, as well as a bright spot overseas in the protests in Libya. But the new Groundwire edition is out, and we're going to start with that. This one is about a Prisoner Justice Day, which came out on August 14th, and feast your ears upon this.
101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial?
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News. This week's episode of Groundwire is a special edition for Prisoner Justice Day, produced by Carly Forbes. In this edition, Peter Collins speaks about the co-optation of Prisoner Justice Day by the Correctional Services of Canada, and about the censorship of a portrait he made of Ashley Smith. In Montreal, there was a demo and walking tour in solidarity with the prisoners of Pelican Bay that also highlighted local industries that profit off the prison industrial complex. And we will also feature the ongoing expansion of Stony Creek Prison just north of Winnipeg and Collins Bay Prison in Kingston. On the community radio report, we will hear from folks who produced the show, Terra Informa. Here are this week's headlines. Justin Pichet, editor of the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons, speaks to recent legislation that has led to overcrowding of prisons.
In the last year or so, we've seen an increase of 1,000 prisoners in the federal penitentiary system. Now, this is largely resulting from pieces of legislation that have been put forward by the Conservative government while they were in minority, so often, you know, opposition parties would sometimes cooperate with the government to pass certain things. So for one, we have the Truth in Sentencing Act that was passed in 2009. That eliminated credit for time served in remand before trial and sentencing for prisoners. So that's creating a capacity or a prison population increase. We're also seeing a series of mandatory minimums, some of which were passed, others which are going to be placed in an omnibus bill in the fall. That's creating a whole series of longer sentences for different types of offenses. And we're also seeing, you know, it's something I think is often overlooked in analyses on the federal penitentiary system, and I'm just as much at fault for this as any other analyst, is that we've seen a bunch of appointments to the judiciary, to parole, and Howard Sapers again mentioned today that we're seeing less people being released on parole than before, and this is a function of the people that the conservatives have put in place that are making decisions about parole. So we're seeing all these kind of different pressures being put on the federal penitentiary system. And, you know, now we're seeing some serious overcrowding issues, increases in the amount of double bunking, which is putting two people in a cell originally designed for one person. That rate is up from 10% this time last year to 13%. So it's also scheduled to rise up to 30%, according to some figures that have been released by the Correctional Service of Canada and the Office of the Correctional Investigator. So we're seeing some serious things happen inside prisons right now.
And now a press release from Julian Ickham and the support crew for Kelly. On Tuesday, August 9th, 2011, in provincial court in Toronto, the judge agreed to a bail variation for the G20 activist Kelly Flugback, which replaces her house arrest with a 10 o'clock curfew and allows her to have unrestricted contact with her fiancé, Julian Ickham, on the condition that he severs his ties with anti-poverty group SOS. These changes to her bail conditions come after a year-long effort by her lawyer, Stephen Gale, and community groups lobbying against the injustice of giving her some of the harshest conditions received by people arrested at the G20. Protests such as the one last Monday, August 5th, where about 16 people, many who worked with her, and others such as members of the Hamilton Steelworkers Local 1005, had a rally and ended up at the Crown Attorney's Office in Guelph, with letters for the Attorney General demanding that conditions that keep her apart from loved ones and her community be removed, have been happening all year in cities such as Guelph, Kitchener-Waterloo, and Victoria, B.C. Kelly is still not allowed to associate with anyone who is known to have ties with SOS, whose Facebook group has more than 195 members, nor is she permitted to attend any public demonstration, which could include something as simple as the Sunday servings that SOS provides. And the fact that her association with her fiancé, Julian Ickham, rests on him severing his ties to SOS shows that the state is not interested in Kelly's guilt or innocence as much as they are dismantling anti-poverty groups such as SOS. When asked about severing ties with SOS, Ickham stated, quote, "Clearly this demonstrates that the issue is not about whether or not Kelly is guilty or innocent of mischief at the G20. Rather, it is about whether or not Kelly is an effective voice for anti-poverty community, a crime that in their eyes is more heinous than all of the smashed windows. I may be forced to quit SOS, but I can't be forced to quit activism. Guelph hasn't heard the last from us yet." End quote. That's it for the headlines. Here's Security Remix by Attract Random.
This security is not for me, no. This security is not for me, no. Humanity's a history of combat, mortal combat, fatal combat, from hand to hand and rules of engagement, to this madness, a war market, them wage war, via profit and or land or water, nation, honor, religion, religion, religion. Watch the TikTok, watch the TikTok, technological, it's an advance, they call call this progress. Is history from fists and sticks and stones to bows and poison tipped arrows, swords and armor, Chinese gunpowder, no more fireworks and water bomb blasts and murder. Cannon ships bring guns and Bibles, divide and conquer, take away Africa's sons and daughters, and industry catapults into modern army rank file order, general sergeant. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
And when their old guns jam, them build new toys. Fast ones blast them with the heavy artillery. Attack, attack, attack. Kamikaze, blitzkrieg, airland and sea, man, woman, soldier, civilian, all fair game. So them breed we hate, so them breed we guerrilla armies. Them teach we martyrs and feed we infidels. Them breed we underground struggle, because
security is not for me, no. This security is not for me, no. This security is the billion dollar, trillion dollar industry.
It's an advance, they call this progress. It's an advance, they call this
progress.
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 And now, 21st century is war. Scale and scope broke exponential. From Arctic espionage to desert dunes, from jungle to city streets. If not war, it's revolution. Why? Because everybody knows they're other now. Everybody knows they're other now. They're born to war, they're taught to hate. They grow to know their enemies across the way. Attracts the sea or state. How did we get here? How did we get this far? The Jew would need a PhD in my own nation's history to understand. My people struggle, we struggle. I am from Cuba, I am from Palestine, I am First Nations, I'm from Afghanistan, I am Sri Lankan. Listen, man, I am from anywhere you can't go. It's not safe, yo. I can't play in my streets all day. Tried to find a playground in my town. Tried to find a safe place to rest your head, not my head. And don't drink the water here. There are no rules at high noon in my town. There are no rules. It's poverty, airstrike, genocide, news media on TV.
On July 16th, a demo took place in Montreal that was in solidarity with the California hunger strike. Elise Eisencraft Klein from CQUT brings us audio from that demo.
On July 1st, thousands of prisoners in long-term isolation units in California prisons began a hunger strike. For many, this strike is an indefinite one. These men are held in their cells for 22.5 to 24 hours per day, most of them for having been labeled active gang members, often based on false information, for instance, the labeling of self-help or cultural groups as gangs. They are served unsanitary and unwholesome food, punished collectively for the actions of individuals, and routinely and without reason denied access to basic programs and amenities, including self-help and educational programs, one phone call per week, and warm clothing. In response to these conditions, these prisoners have united to put their own lives on the line. As one prisoner explained, no one wants to die, yet under this current system of what amounts to intense torture, what choice do we have? If one is to die, it will be on our own terms. The prisoners' demands are as follows. First of all, eliminating group punishments, abolishing the debriefing policy, and modifying active-inactive gang status criteria, complying with the recommendations of the U.S. Commission on Safety and Abuse in Prisons regarding an end to long-term solitary confinement, providing adequate food, expanding and providing constructive programs and privileges for indefinite SHU inmates. The U.S. now holds over 2 million prisoners, almost 100,000 of them in isolation. Meanwhile, Canada is adopting similar crime and punishment policies to those of the U.S., the country with the world's highest incarceration rate. Between 2005 and 2012, the Correctional Services of Canada, or CSC, budget will have doubled as thousands of new cages are built to accommodate a massive forthcoming increase in the number of prisoners. Searching for the best ways to keep more and more people locked up, CSC officials have visited supermax prisons in the U.S. similar to Pelican Bay. I was there speaking to demonstrators this past Saturday.
Hi. So what's your name?
My name is Helen Hudson.
And we're using this opportunity to make the link to expansions that are being being planned in the Canadian prison system under the Harper's new omnibus crime bill, but that I want to emphasize are not solely Harper's ideas. Like, some of these plans were set in motion under the Liberals. So Canada is actually looking towards, moving towards the U.S.'s style of prison industrial complex, where we're looking to lock more people up, that sort of tough on crime philosophy, where we're basically warehousing large sectors of marginalized people long term. What we're doing today is we're walking around downtown Montreal, Old Montreal area. We're now heading into Griffintown, stopping at contractors that in one way or another are benefiting from and participating in prison expansion. Architecture firms, groups that finance prison expansions, groups that build furnitures or profit off the labor of prisoners that are paid a maximum of $1.50 an hour to build furniture for the prisons themselves. So that's what we're doing. We're going around to several companies that are profiting and making our presence known, and at the same time making the link to the protests that are going on in California right now.
Cool, thank you.
In Canada, there is only one operational security housing unit, and it's in Saint-Anne-des-Plaines, Quebec. It's slightly different from the security housing units at Pelican Bay in that there are fewer long-term prisoners. People usually end up in the security housing unit in Canada, in Canadian prisons, as a punishment for something that they've done, or as a way of forcing people to admit to something that they've done or to snitch on others. But people are usually in for a matter of 18 months and then put back into general population. Whereas in Pelican Bay, there have been people who have been in isolation for up to 40 years. Correctional Services of Canada are looking to expand the kinds of security housing units that are currently in Canadian prisons. They did a tour of one of the most severe security housing units in the United States at Florence, Colorado, as a way of understanding the prison and how it functions and a way of modeling it in Canada. With them, they took a bunch of mortgage companies who provide the backing and the financial assessments in order to move these projects forward. So it's clear that this is more than just sort of a curiosity trip. They're actually putting these plans into effect. On top of that, all of the companies that back prisons on a financial level in the United States often back prisons in Canada as well. So all of the big banks like Bank of America, Bank of Montreal, Merrill Lynch Financial Group, all provide money to either the government or the state or private corporations in order to allow them to finance prisons even further. So those are the kind of the connections that we're trying to draw out.
Okay, and you had stops on this demo tour that you're doing that were connected to prisons. Like, what kind of places did you stop at?
We stopped at Sodexo, which provides food to Canadian prisons and European prisons. They also provide food in a lot of hospitals, universities, and high schools. We're sort of denouncing them as part of the prison system at large for providing kind of low-quality food consistently. Again, looking to make the most money that they can off incarcerated people.
Okay, and this is related to your own research as well, right?
I have provided a lot of the research for this tour, and it's something that I think is really important to understand how the prison system can expand like this, especially in times of economic downturn. I think it's important to understand how the prison industrial complex can continue to expand in ways that other industries aren't able to. Largely it's due to the way that prisons are kind of an ever-expanding sort of thing. You know, if you build more prisons, there's more jobs created, there's more industries that are going to then fuel that.
Peter Collins speaks on how the Correctional Service of Canada, CSC, has co-opted Prisoners' Justice Day.
One of the problems that's been happening in over the course of August 10th is the prison administrations have tried to shut it down, and they try to shut it down in different ways. You know, like sometimes they would charge people for not going to work, throw people in the hole. That became more difficult for them, and so what they did is became more subversive in their efforts to punish people for participating in the day. And what they've been doing lately is they've been trying to co-opt the day, and what they did last year was they refused at this prison anyway. I don't know about other prisons, you know, so you know, maybe some of your listeners could let me know what's happening at their prison insofar as this particular issue goes. What they did last year was they refused to allow us to print t-shirts with our artwork design on it without signing over the rights to our artwork to CSC, and then they would allow us to print them. So last year I refused to allow them to do, you know, to have the rights of my artwork because that's an outrageous request on their part. And someone else did give them the rights to their artwork, and so this the prison the inmate committee here allowed that to go forward for reasons that are completely beyond me. And this year it would appear that they've done the same thing again. And, you know, it's kind of a shocking, very disgraceful kind of approach to August 10th when the people who are actually responsible for many of the deaths now are demanding that they own the artwork commemorating these people's deaths. And so, you know, I guess I would encourage people not to allow them to own their artwork and not to buy shirts that are owned by them. You know, it just seems to be completely completely wrong on so many levels. And you know, if you can't get shirts made, then just you know, cut a black sock and wear an armband. You know, don't wear an August 10th design that's owned by the prison system.
So could you tell us what happened in regards to this piece of artwork?
I had wanted to do a portrait of Ashley Smith and, you know, to, you know, commemorate her life. And I guess they had seen the picture and came and confiscated it at 2 o'clock yesterday, which I think was, what, May 25th?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, they gave me a confiscation slip saying that the artwork was unauthorized and it was contraband, and so they actually have possession of that portrait now. And I think it's, you know, particularly interesting because just recently there was a news report where during the public inquiry into poor Ashley's death, the Guards Union, through the Attorney General, asked that all of the videos which showed their conduct during the, you know, the year leading up to her, you know, provoked suicide was, they wanted it not to be shown to the public inquiry. And the judge ruled against them, saying that their conduct in that all those situations leading up to her death were relevant to the public inquiry. And so when the judge ruled against them on that, yesterday I saw on the news that the union, through the Attorney General, wants the faces of the guards blurred out so that they're not recognized. And and that's the same day that they confiscated her portrait, you know. And I just think it's so indicative of an organization that, you know, I guess thrives on unaccountability and like a... I think probably anybody who's committed a crime on video would also like their identity blurred out from, you know, the scrutiny of a court. Well, I do understand what their motivation is. They would just prefer that the wall of silence and secrecy remain in place and that nothing they do ever reaches the public ear or eyes.
Correctional Services Canada has started preliminary work on the expansion of two federal prisons, Collins Bay Institution in Kingston, Ontario, and Stony Mountain Institution north of Winnipeg. At Stony Mountain, a new 96-bed maximum security unit will be built with an expected construction cost of $20 million. The John Howard Society of Manitoba works with offenders and ex-offenders before, during, and after their incarceration. John Hutton is the executive director of the John Howard Society of Manitoba, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, John. What information have you been provided about the plan changes at Stony Mountain?
Formally, no information at all. And it could just be that they simply don't see the need to publicize what they're doing because they're not interested in the response. That's the best case scenario. The worst case is that they are trying to slip in something without people knowing. And that's what we would call a super prison, where this is actually just the first step. They would add a maximum security wing at Stony Mountain and then take the Rockwood Institution, which is a minimum security, and roll it into the Stony Mountain prison as well, and then you'd have one prison housing all classifications of inmates. but it would actually create a lot of challenges, and mixing the populations is likely to add more stress, more violence, and more challenges for the staff and for the inmates themselves. And it's likely to also cause a very severe deterioration in the level of care and safety for the inmates at those institutions. Puts more restrictions on both the medium and the minimum security. It might create a wall around the minimum where one doesn't exist right now, which would really change the nature of minimum security. And if you add a maximum to a medium and then bring in a minimum and create this super prison, you're probably going to end up with higher costs because you're going to have a greater level of security for everyone, even those that aren't needing it or aren't getting it right now.
The federal government isn't alone in wanting more prison beds in Manitoba. From what I've heard, both the provincial government as well as the union that represents workers in prison are also talking about the problems with overcrowding and the need, but a lot of the need is also coming from the federal government's tough-on-crime mm-hmm. policies. Is there any evidence that these policies will reduce crime or make Manitoba safer?
Absolutely not. The government hasn't presented any evidence, nor is there any evidence to show that incarcerating people for longer periods of time, imposing minimum sentences, making it harder for people to get a parole, to get their parole. These are the three basic components of the so-called tough on crime, or what I refer to as a punitive approach to crime, have any effect on the on crime rates at all. The government hasn't produced any evidence to show it'll make a difference, and in the United States, where this has been going on for 30 years, not only have they abandoned this particular approach as being totally unworkable and hugely expensive, there was no benefit.
Thank you to Josh Brandon and Karen McIntosh from CKUW in Winnipeg for sharing that interview, and now we will hear an interview by Ann Hansen with Robin from EPIC about prison expansion in Kingston.
So as you know, Kingston has the highest concentration of prisons of any city in Canada, with 7 prisons in this area. According to Kingston Economic Development Corporation, KETCO, Correctional Services of Canada, employs almost 4,200 people in town, making it the third largest employer here. Proponents building new prisons or expanding existing prisons suggest such projects will boost the local economy and create new jobs, but the evidence says otherwise. And you can look at case studies from the California Prison Moratorium Project for more information about that. To address the myth that prison expansion will mean a lot of new jobs for Kingston residents or economic benefits to local businesses, it's likely that a lot of the new jobs will go to outside applicants. Many of the jobs, such as construction, will be short-term. Few of the contracts for prison design, construction, maintenance, and services will go to local businesses. And you can see that by looking at the contracts that have been awarded so far. The design contracts for Bath and Collins Bay have been awarded to Noor Limited, based in Ottawa. The design contract for expansion of Millhaven has gone to Parkin Architects Limited, based in Toronto. The fencing and site preparation contract for Bath has been awarded to Peninsula Construction, located in Fawn Hill, Ontario. And finally, the fencing and site prep contract for Collins Bay has gone to S.A. Sutcliffe Excavating, located in Bethany, Ontario. So as far as I know, so far, not a single contract has actually gone to a Kingston business. There will be short-term construction jobs that will go to Kingston residents, likely, but all the profits coming from those projects won't be reinvested in Kingston. It's also possible that incarcerated workers will displace workers on the outside from their jobs. In my job at the PSAC, the Public Service Alliance of Canada, I've heard a rumor that CFB Kingston might begin using prisoners to do maintenance on the base and to also work in the mess hall. So the PSAC local there is concerned that if inmate workers are assigned to do their work, then it'll end up busting their union. So, that's a concern to me, but greater concern is prison labor and incarcerated people being forced to work for extremely low wages, if any wages, as part of their correctional plans.
On this episode's Community Radio Report, I sat down with Steve Anderson, a longtime contributor to Terra Informa. Terra Informa is an Edmonton-based environmental news program that broadcasts on campus and community radio stations across the country.
I think we're currently broadcasting on 18 stations in 60-some communities.
Wow. So what are some of the challenges and rewards of having to make your show relevant to such a diverse audience, to so many communities across the country?
I think the challenge is always just getting it done on time. But as far as making it relevant, I think that's actually one of the funnest parts. It was a little bit of a challenge when we first switched from being a local show to one that was played nationally. But now that we're sort of getting the hang of it, it's really interesting to see what's going on in all of the different communities. We try to make a point of still being a local station, even or a local show, even though we're broadcast all over the place, by keeping track of what's going on in the community. So we're still covering local events, just from another city, kind of.
So I guess, what are some of the examples of some of the topics or stories that you've been covering?
Well, a really big one right now is fracking, which is a method of natural gas and oil production. And that's really big right now in Quebec and the Maritimes. There's a lot of opposition to that. We also just did a road trip across BC, collecting coverage of different people's stories surrounding the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which is this huge project that's proposed to link refineries near Edmonton that are processing tar sands, crude oil, to the port in Kitimat in BC. And there's huge opposition to that as well. So,
yeah, actually, I've heard good things about your road trip. Could you tell me a little bit more about that experience?
Yeah, it was really interesting. We were really lucky to get a grant from the Alberta Public Interest Research Group to fund the trip, and it allowed us to spend, I think it was 7 days on the road visiting all the little communities along the route of the pipeline. And I'm a little bit scared. We've just started editing the audio, but I think we've got something like 20 hours that we recorded that we're going to have to edit down. So it's going to be interesting. But what really stood out for me was that pretty much everywhere we went, people knew about the project. We weren't sure when we left how informed people would be, but yeah, there's a lot of people who are quite worried about it.
So where can people find out more about Terra Informa or listen to your show?
They can swing by our website, which is terrainforma.ca, and it lists the stations that were aired on and the times that we broadcast, and you can also download podcasts of the show from there.
Great. Thanks for talking with me.
Cool. Thanks.
That was Steve Anderson of Terra Informa, an Edmonton-based national environmental news program. Terra Informa is just entering their 9th season and recently won 2 national awards through the NCRA for Best Current Affairs Program and Best Documentary Piece. I'm Sam Kriviak from CJSR in Edmonton, reporting for Groundwire.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. Special thanks to Dee from Prison Radio at CKUT in Montreal for much of the content used in this episode.
And thanks to all the hard work that went into that informative piece. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Martin Lemlin. We'll be back in just a minute with the latest on the Libyan front.
He's off to a good start. Guests are on time. Everyone's out to have fun and to help others fun.
What's the matter? Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
UBC students have an alternative. Looking to unwind? Check out one of the sub's 2 licensed establishments.
The Pit Pub and Burger Bar is home of the famous Pit Night. Relax with great prices on cold beer and lots of big screen HD TVs, or chow down on charbroiled burgers, beer battered fish and chips, and Belgian fries. The Pit is open 7 days a week, and Wednesday through Saturday is open late until 2 a.m. This business is owned and operated by the AMS, your student society.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot and salute?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet,
Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. Stay tuned for Clapping Hands, Sore Throats Clapping Hands with Robert, coming up right after this. First of all, in international news, Libyan rebels gained control of their capital city, Tripoli, yesterday. Now, despite the fact that the head of Libya's National Transitional Council, or the NTC, announced at the end of the Gaddafi era, fighting continued today in parts of Tripoli as tanks left Gaddafi's compound in Bab al-Ziza to confront the rebel assault that took control of the capital in an overnight battle. Many streets in the center of the city that had seen jubilant celebrations just hours earlier were abandoned as pockets of pro-Gaddafi resistance, along with snipers and artillery fire, made the area quite dangerous. Now, the rebels have one last push to make towards Bab al-Aziza, where Gaddafi keeps his compound, although it's unclear when they'll make the push. There are also reports of sustained gunshots coming inside the compound itself. While the smoke settles in Libya, we can be sure at this point that Gaddafi's three sons are in custody. His son Sadiq was captured by rebel forces in Tripoli. Saif al-Islam was also captured in western Tripoli. He's wanted by the International Criminal Court, who's in the process of bargaining with the rebels to turn Saif over to their custody. And also his son Muhammad, who surrendered to the rebels, although there are reports now that are surfacing that says he's escaped their custody at some point today. Egypt has already formally acknowledged the NTC as Libya's governing body. For more on this ongoing struggle, we're going to throw things over to FSRN.
Today in Libya, opposition forces continue to clash with troops loyal to Muammar Gaddafi in the capital city, though much of Tripoli appeared to be under the opposition's control. On Sunday, after 6 months of fighting, forces allied with the National Transitional Council, or NTC, pushed through Tripoli and met little resistance, filling squares with celebrations that lasted late into the night. But today, fighting continued. Mustafa Abdel Jalil is chair of the opposition government. He called the capture of Tripoli an epic battle that was waged by all segments of society, including youth and women. He spoke from Benghazi earlier today.
الآن أقول وبكل شفافية أن حقبة القذافي بكل ما سويها قد انتهت.
And now I say with all transparency that the era of Gaddafi is over.
وعلى الشعب الليبي أن يدرك بأن المرحلة القادمة لن تكون مفروشة بالورود.
Libyans must know and must realize that the coming period will not be a bed of roses.
فأمامنا الكثير من التحديات وعلينا الكثير من المسؤوليات.
We face many challenges and we have many responsibilities.
ابتداء من معالجة الجروح ووضع أيدينا بأيدي بعض.
Beginning with healing the wounds and putting our hands into each other's hands.
Sound courtesy of Al Jazeera. Three of Gaddafi's sons have been reportedly captured. The International Criminal Court has issued charges against Gaddafi and one of his sons for crimes against humanity. Speaking of a post-Gaddafi era, opposition leader Jalil said justice would take its course.
And on tolerance, forbearance, and forgiveness.
وعلى بناء دولة القانون
and on building a state of law
التي ستوفر محاكمة عادلة
which will provide fair trials
لكل من تضرر ولكل من اتهم في إحداث ذلك الضرر
for all people who were victims and for all those who were accused with causing this damage.
The opposition was aided by NATO forces. Speaking today, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the decision on when to end the military operation would be, quote, up to NATO based on security situations.
It is crucial now for the conflict to end with no further loss of life and retribution. I welcome the assurances given by the chairman of the National Transitional Council, Mr. Mustafa Abdul Jalil, that extreme care would be taken to protect people and public institutions and to maintain law and order. I call on Colonel Gaddafi's forces to cease violence immediately and make way for a smooth transition.
Ban Ki-moon said a meeting would take place later this week to discuss the future of Libya and would include representatives from the African Union, the League of Arab States, and the European Union. In Syria, at least two more protesters were killed today as unrest persists. The government is coming under increasing pressure both at home and abroad. Dozens are reported dead from the crackdown on the weekend's protests. And opposition figures are meeting in Turkey to draft plans for President Bashar al-Assad's removal. Our reporter in Lebanon, Zach Brophy, has been with Syrian refugees in northern Lebanon to hear their take on the unfolding events.
Aliman School sits in a field on the edge of a sleepy village in northern Lebanon, only a couple of miles from the Syrian border. It is now a refuge for nearly 150 Syrians who have fled from the violence and disorder back home.
I came here out of fear of detention, death and terror. There is no security. I came here looking for security.
Mohammed Khudr Wa'alum has a 7-inch scar across his brow and a row of inflamed wounds on his arms. He says he was beaten unconscious at a demonstration by the security forces and thugs loyal to the government.
I was on the ground and they were stepping on me and hitting me. I was bleeding and they were still hitting me. I started crying for help. Every time someone tried to help me out, they would start shooting at them. They don't even let the ambulance get to me. The forces kept asking me, "You want freedom? You want the regime to fall? You want Assad to go?"
Human rights groups claim around 2,200 people have been killed and thousands arrested since the protests started in March. The regime responds that hundreds of security personnel have been killed and that terrorist groups are fomenting instability in the country. Another refugee, a woman who had escaped to Lebanon with her two young children, said they felt isolated.
Until now, there has been no international interference. Even the Arab nations have no opinion on this. Withdrawing their ambassadors is not a big issue. They are not pressuring or affecting the president. It's been 4 months now and nothing new.
In recent days, international pressure on the regime has been mounting. Last week, the US, Britain, France, Germany and Spain called for al-Assad to step aside. The US implemented additional economic sanctions and the EU is drafting sanctions aimed at Syria's oil industry. This could have a large impact on the economy and President Assad relies on support from much of Syria's weighty merchant classes. In a televised interview Sunday, President Assad said his government was still in control.
We are really able to deal with the situation and we achieved security achievements. We cannot reveal them, but we have some procedures and I'm not concerned at all. I am not concerned at all. We can deal with the situation.
Translation from the BBC. Another important pillar of support for the government is the military. Abdul Hakim Abdullah was a conscript in the Republican Guard, but defected along with dozens of others after refusing to follow orders. He escaped to Lebanon with his family early last week.
We were sent on a mission and the people were coming out from prayers and we were ordered to shoot. We refused the order. When we refused, they rounded us up and took us to our base. They started to beat us and ask us why we disobeyed the orders. The people who were praying, are these the armed groups they were talking about? These are our families, our friends, our brothers.
If group defections continue within the security forces, it could erode the government's ability to continue the military crackdown. Over the course of the uprising, President Assad has made four televised appearances. In each one, he has ceded more in terms of promised reforms. He also initiated a national dialogue in June, but some key opposition blocs boycotted the talks. Abdul Rahman Mohammed Ali Al-Aqari is the spokesman for the refugees at Al-Iman School.
The people in the beginning of the demonstrations were asking for reform, but as soon as the regime started to use dirty and oppressive tactics and the first drop of blood was shed, then we started to demand the downfall of the regime.
On Sunday, President Assad promised more concessions, including local elections within months and parliamentary elections in February 2012. However, he was insistent that security was a prerequisite to reform.
The solution in Syria is a political one, but if there is violence, it should be met. Police, security, riot police, any country in the world, they use these means to quash any anti-social behavior.
Translation from Al Jazeera. The UN Human Rights Council is convening in a special session to discuss the crisis in Syria. The Syrian government has granted access to a UN humanitarian team so they can assess the situation in the country. Meanwhile, next door in Turkey, opposition groups have met to form a national council aimed at ousting President Assad. Zach Brophy, FSRN, Mashta Hamoud, Northern Lebanon.
And thanks to FSRN for bringing us those stories. If you'd like to learn more about what they do at the Free Speech Radio News, you can find it at fsrn.org. We're listening to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. It's now time for your weekday weather forecast. And the good news here is that today just happened to be a fluke. Tonight we're going to see some drizzle or periods of rain ending early this evening, and then it's going to be cloudy, which is pretty much going to continue on through tomorrow, but it shouldn't rain. It's going to be a high of 21, about a low of 15 tomorrow. It's going to stay mainly cloudy, clearing in the afternoon, some fog patches dissipating in the morning, but it should not rain. Wednesday is going to be a mix of sun and cloud, a 30% chance of showers, but a high of 22, and from there on in, we're clear sailing. Bright sunshine right through to Sunday, highs of 23, lows of 13, you can take my word for it. That is your weekday weather forecast. I'm Martin Lemlin. Right in just a minute here, we're going to be talking about some sad news that hit Canada's official leader of the opposition today.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts downtown at 212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, Heart and Soul Clothing Incorporated, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Scratch Records, True Value Vintage, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A, positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101. I am Martin Lemlin. We are broadcasting live from the Student Union Building right here on campus at UBC. And, in federal news, this morning at 5:45 a.m. Eastern Time, Jack Layton, leader of the New Democratic Party of Canada and the official opposition, died in his home after a long battle with cancer. At 61 years old, he died peacefully, surrounded by family and loved ones. Once it became clear that the treatment he was pursuing wasn't working out as he had hoped, he wrote a letter to friends and indeed all Canadians that called for hope, more or less. He recommended that MP Nicole Turmel continue her work as interim leader until a permanent successor is elected, which he suggested happen as soon as possible after the new year to give the new leader as much time as possible to consolidate the team and move forward with their progress and their ideas. He ended the letter. I mean, it's hard to say. To lose Jack at the height of his capacity as a person and as a political leader is especially sad. When he became leader of the NDP, he took on a party that had seen better days, and he led it to become a force and that could win the next election. And his breakthrough in Quebec is indeed historic, a transformative event in Canada's political history. And he would, in his letter, he'd like Canadians to move forward, and especially called upon his caucus members to bind together and to push forward in the goals that they'd set forward in the election. He ended with the words, "My friends, love is better than anger. Hope is better than fear. Optimism is better than despair. So let us be loving, hopeful, and optimistic, and we'll change the world. All my very best, Jack Layton. And that is pretty much going to do it for our show on today, August 22nd, 2011. Thanks you very much for listening. If you'd like to get involved with the show, share a comment, or give us a hot news tip, please don't hesitate to contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or better yet, you can email us at news@citr.ca. Be sure to follow us on Twitter under the username CITRNews. And from all of us here at the news team, thanks for listening, and stay tuned for our next newscast on Friday at 5 p.m. In the meantime, we've got Robert coming up with Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. I'm Martin Lumlin. Thanks for listening.
Everything's broken here.